Today's Teisho is on Case 42 in the Book of Serenity, Nan Yang's Water Pitcher. Introduction, washing the bowl, adding water to the pitcher, are all aspects of the teaching, Buddha work. Hauling firewood and carrying water are all miraculous powers of sublime functions. Why can't you emanate light and make the earth move? Case. A monk asked national teacher Zhong of Nanyang, what is the Virochana of one's own body? The national teacher said, bring me the pitcher of clean water. The monk brought the pitcher. The national teacher said, put it back where it was before. The monk asked again, what is the Virochana in one's own body? The national teacher said, the ancient Buddha is long gone. Verse. Birds coursing in the sky, fishes being in the water, in rivers and lakes forgetting. In clouds and sky they get their will, the doubting mind a single thread. Before the face a thousand miles, knowing benevolence, requiting benevolence, how many people do? As some of you may know, I have a job at running the writing program here at Rutgers. And the writing program serves almost 12,000 students every year. So it's an enormous enterprise. And you know, there are many universities in the United States that don't have 12,000 students. So it's quite a big operation. And we have more than almost 600 sections every year, and more than 200 people teach in the writing program, maybe 250. And many of those teachers are temporary. A lot of them are graduate students in other disciplines besides English. Some are graduate students in English. And a great number of them are what we call part-time lecturers. In the university today, there are professors. And there are professors at various ranks. But a lot of the teaching is done by TAs and another group. Part-time lecturers. And so these part-time lecturers are quite important to the university. They're really very important. Professors today represent about 21% of all the university teaching staff. Only 21%, less than a quarter. If you walk into a classroom, there's a 3 out of 4 chance, better than 3 out of 4, that person isn't a professor. It could be a TA. There's probably a 1 in 4 chance it's a TA. Otherwise, it's going to be a part-time lecturer. And part-time lecturers are often people who have, they're working to get an advanced degree. Often they're graduate students who have run out of financial support in their degree programs. And so they look for a part-time job teaching writing. And I advertise in the New York Times in the summer for teachers of writing. And put an ad in the paper, and I get hundreds of applications from all over the tri-state area, from Connecticut, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, And these are people who are trying to piece together enough money to finish their PhDs often. Or they're going to be writers and they're trying to get a Master's of Fine Arts degree. And anyway, they need money and they don't have money. And they want to have, often they want some kind of an academic job. And they're trying to complete this crucial aspect. It's crucial to their lives. You can't be an academic, you can't be a professor without your PhD. Pretty much you've got to have it. And they don't have enough money to get it, so they're trying to make a little money. And Rutgers doesn't pay a lot of money per course. It only pays about $4,000 a course. So basically, people usually teach, these part-time lecturers usually teach two courses a semester. So they make $8,000 a semester if they just teach here. But many of them teach at other institutions too. So they might teach in New York a couple sections, and then they come down on the train and they might teach, believe it or not, a few sections in northern New Jersey, and then they might teach a few sections down here. And then they get on the train again and go home. So believe it or not, thousands of people live this way. And it's a difficult life, you know. They have no health benefits, although I would like to see them get health benefits and have been working towards that goal, and it might happen within the next, say, 5 years. They don't get any health benefits, and they're paid pretty much by the semester. And they can show up for work, and a person can tell them your sections have been canceled. So, very difficult life. I myself have done that kind of thing. I myself have been a part-time lecturer. And it's a difficult life, you know, because you might be teaching at several different places, several different institutions. And you have very few things to help you. You don't always have an office, you know, for example. You don't get much professional respect. Anyway, I've been spending many weeks now interviewing people who saw my advertisement in the New York Times, and they drive down to Rutgers or they come in on the train, and I interview them for a job teaching here. And even though the pay is not very good, and it's very labor intensive, they're very eager to get the job. They're actually nervous in the interview. And lately I've been doing group interviews, so we might have two or three people coming in at the same time, and it makes people a lot less tense. I'm interested in finding good people, people who will work hard and who are intelligent and who are committed to undergraduate education. I want to make sure when they come down for an interview that they took a shower, you know? Seriously. I want to make sure they look clean and neat, and that they're sane, you know, because not everybody in the academic world is sane. And I want to make sure that they seem like decent people who would treat their students well. And so I am looking them over, you know, sort of with a critical eye. But on the other hand, I know how they live, and I work very, very hard to make their experience a good one. And I'm always happy when people leave with a big smile on their face, and I think they almost always do. People shake my hand very warmly, and they thank me, because I work very hard to make them feel welcome and needed, you know, needed. I think it's very, very important for people to feel needed and part of something that's worth doing, you know, and cared about. And as I say, I myself have done this kind of part-time work, and I didn't feel needed, and I didn't feel cared about. And so I really work hard to make it a humane experience. It works out very well. You know, I get really, year after year, I get really excellent people to come and work here. And they go on to really interesting lives. Some of them become writers. And I read reviews of their books. You know, they go on to other jobs. And some of them go on to become professors. All kinds of different things. You know, different. Some go to law school, you know, and so on. But I'm always struck by how hard it is sometimes in our society to feel cared about and part of something. You know, that you're not outside, you're inside, you're a part of something. You're valued and you're cared about. And one of the things I notice is how hungry people are for that kind of an expression of concern or an expression of respect. And as I say, I work very hard during these interviews to make people feel relaxed and to make them feel wanted. And I always say, I'm very eager to have you work here. You know, I hope you'll accept my invitation. See. So I want them to leave thinking that which is true, I want them to work there, but I want them to feel like I'm working hard to get them to come. And they really become very warm and friendly when they see that I care about them. And that's one way that I can help to make their lives a little better. But I do think it's a very scary society. The other day, somebody came in to sit. I guess it was last night. Came in to sit here, and this person is a graduate student, and she had not done meditation before, and she had a good experience from it. And she said, "I really want to do meditation because I'm having a lot of problems with stress." You know, a lot of problems with stress. I don't know if she has been on medication, but she kept saying, "I don't want to go on medication." Yeah. So I think she's having like serious stress problems. And I know so many people in her situation, so many people who are just like ready to blow up with stress, you know. They're just so frightened. And she's a graduate student, and she's working with some very good people I know who actually are very nice people. You know, they're not the kind of people who would yell at you or, but the whole thing, the whole setup makes you frightened, I think, you know. Our society is a very competitive society. People get a message early in their lives that competition is central to society. And the society is competitive at every level. And people get that message. You know, I mean, we get grades in school. One of the first moments when people, experience the competitiveness of society is when they're applying to colleges. You know, so you know, most people are pretty protected in the United States when they're going to high school. But sometimes it's a big shock when they apply to colleges and realize that, they're actually going to be rejected. Sometimes actually, your parents aren't going to reject you. You know, usually. They might want to sometime, and you might want to reject your parents. people, often applying to universities is the first time people really experience rejection. And then, you know, it begins to dawn on people that, this is not the last rejection. You know, unless I am very careful, this could happen again. And at any rate, I think people like this graduate student, you know, she's an intelligent young woman. She's working with top people in the field. And she's, you know, they're nice people, and yet she's very, very nervous. And she probably thinks the problem is with her. You know, she probably thinks I something wrong with me. But I think that the society is not very caring. That, you know, in so many different ways, it doesn't send to people a message that you're valued, you're loved, you're cared about, your well-being is important. You know. About 6 months ago, in my house is an old house. It's almost 100 years old, and the windows were the original windows, and they were literally falling apart. I spent many summers fixing them about maybe 12 years ago. But, they just are beyond repair, so we had to get new windows in the house. And some of the workers, most of the workers who worked on our house were Latino people from Central and South America. And, we've had a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment lately in the newspapers, and all of these people are immigrants, and some, I don't know, maybe they're even illegal immigrants, I don't know. But they worked so hard putting in the windows in the house, and they were such nice people. And when they were treated, when they were treated with respect, they became so warm and friendly. My wife is, a very nice person. And sometimes she would make them breakfast, and she would make them scrambled eggs and turkey sausages. And coffee, And also, she speaks Spanish because she comes from New Mexico. And she would converse with them in Spanish, and, they felt so dignified, And I myself used to know Spanish, but I know hardly any of it anymore because it's been 30 years, and I was never that good in Spanish. But, I would still say, Buenos dias, and mucho gusto, and ask them simple questions, and it made a difference. I was trying to meet them halfway, and I think they felt cared about and respected. I think in our society, people get a message that they aren't cared about and they aren't respected. And that basically you have to really work very hard to be worthy of respect, and that probably you won't wind up being worthy of respect. I think people deeply fear that. I think there's something about the way people are raised that does not encourage them to look well upon themselves. And I think people have profound profound sense of unhappiness about who they are and what they are and so on. I think this is really present in our society. Just yesterday, I read a poll, one of these crazy polls they do all the time, and it said that 50% of Americans are unhappy. I don't know how much credence to put in things like that, but I suspect that sounds right. And I think part of it is just that this whole idea of feeling like you're not worth anything. You're not worth anything. You know, at one time, the Dalai Lama actually talked about this. He said that he was working with American students, and he was so shocked to see how often they felt unhappy with themselves, very discontented, or very unworthy. And he said it surprised him, because he said in his culture that would be considered quite unusual for people to feel that they were, really unworthy or really, deficient. So, one way to deal with this problem is, try to build self-esteem, and you can try to respect yourself more, and you can make a point of reminding yourself that you're worth respect, and that you're a good person, and so on. And if that works for you, that's wonderful. You might remember that guy on Saturday Night Live. What was his name? I can't remember right now, but. He used to do his daily affirmation. He had his program. Remember, he was this very cute guy. And he'd say, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and darn it, people like me, And it's funny, because I think, he was making a joke out of it, but I think people do feel unworthy, And of course, Stuart was his name, right? Stuart. And he was funny because, of course, it didn't really work that well, right? He still was pretty shaky. So anyway, that's one way of trying to deal with the problem. I think another way to deal with the problem is not trying to be a self so much, not trying to be like to find a worthy self, or trying to win the approval of others through your achievements. Now, please understand what I'm saying. There's nothing wrong with going to graduate school, or being a professor, or striving to accomplish things in life. That's part of life, and it's very, very valuable. But no matter how much you achieve, you still may not feel worthy, I have said this before, but I know people who have, they're just the envy of everybody around them. They are, there's a person in my department who's published like 9 books, I just think that's amazing. He must just get up and start writing and go to bed, get up and write, At one point in his life, I know for a fact that he had like very serious drinking problem and anger issues and so on. Now, there are people who have written 9 books who don't have those problems, but the writing the 9 books doesn't necessarily solve the problem, it's interesting how deeply insecure successful people often are, one way to solve this problem is to try to have your daily affirmation. And another way to solve this problem is to try to achieve a lot. And maybe you can convince yourself that you're worthy of respect. Although it's very hard to do. But I also think that there's another approach to this whole issue. You might not have gotten started in meditation because you are unhappy with yourself. But I think a lot of people do. You know, people get to be very boxed in life. And you know, when you sit on the cushion, it's at the very least it's a relief, right, from all of these pressures, which mostly, many of our pressures we really put on ourselves, actually. You know, this young woman who came to sit, you know, was clearly very articulate, and she seemed quite intelligent to me, you know. And she had just been doing some research on her own, and you know, I mean, she was working with some of the top people in her department. I know them personally, and they're, I think those are some of the people who have written 9 books, you know. And yet, you know, she was so afraid of failing and not being good enough. And so she came in to sit down on the cushion, and she did 2 sets, 2 periods of meditation. And she did indeed feel much better and said she was coming back. I don't know if she will, but, you know, something about this made her feel better. And I think that's quite important, you know. You know, when we sit on the cushion and you watch the breath and you begin to enter a samadhi, one of the things that can happen to you is that you begin to have this very powerful sense of well-being. You know, this is, if people stick with sitting, it's usually because they've had this experience. You know, you come in and you're tense and frightened, and you start watching your breath and you struggle with 1,000 different thoughts and so on. But if you keep coming back to the moment, sooner or later, you know, your thoughts are going to recede, and you're going to begin to have this vague sense of, like, safety or well-being. Maybe it might just feel like the pressure is off your shoulders, you know. But there's this sense of safety or well-being. And I think this is quite wonderful. You know, it's quite wonderful. And it's very reassuring, you know, or it should be. You know, people are so tied up in knots that even having this experience at first is just a little tiny bit of help. And you don't always get there, of course. You know, sometimes you come in and you're frightened and angry, or frightened and, you know, in pain, emotional pain or distress. And you sit and you don't get that kind of release. But if you keep practicing, eventually you get it. And the more you have it, the easier it is to get there. Where you're in the moment, and all of a sudden there's this deep sense of connectedness to things. You know, or just safety. You know, safety and peace. Right? This is, I think, so... This is just like the greatest gift in the world. Because, you know, you don't have to achieve anything to experience it, you know? It's just present. It's like an undercurrent, undercurrent in our life all the time. You know, it's like we're searching desperately for something, and we're trying every strategy to get it. And failing often, right? And then you sit down on the cushion and you just keep bringing your mind back to the moment, and often there's this profound sense of relief or well-being. And this is, you know, easy at first to just, you know, overlook. You think, well, at least I'm not in pain anymore. And then, of course, people leave and they go back into their familiar mental habits of projecting into the future, worrying, being dissatisfied with their performance, and so on. But if you keep coming back to the cushion, sooner or later, even though fear has made us all rather unintelligent, you know, actually, we begin to notice that there's this other way of experiencing the world, and that there's this the possibility of being deep, this feeling of being deeply connected to things is not as remote as we thought. You know, it's right when it happens to you, you realize this is here all the time. You know, and you might think, why can't I always be here? But you'll often have this impression, or you'll become aware that there's this is really here all the time. It's like the ground of our existence, you know. My feeling is that this is like our salvation, you know. That when you begin to enter this state, it's like returning to kind of I think sort of natural condition for the human being. This is like natural condition for the human being. This sense of connectedness, of being home, of being at the center of life, or however you want to put it, is our natural, but really natural state. And I think that we don't experience it all the time because we have created a kind of a toxic culture, if I may say so. I mean, I was reading in the newspaper the other day, just yesterday, that the Arctic ice is going to be open this summer for the first time. It's going to go, there will be no, the ice shield over the Arctic is going to go away. This was predicted 20 years ago. And the thing that amazed me about this story was that it wasn't front page news, you know. I mean, I don't actually get the newspaper, I read it online. But, you know, it wasn't the opening story. I would have thought that this would be like at the top of the masthead, you know. But it was like page two or something. You know, it's like the important thing was, I don't remember what was at the top of the page, but it was relatively trivial. Right? I think it was the ruling on handguns, which is actually not that trivial. But it's certainly not as important as the opening of the ice cap over the Arctic. And you have to say, you know, why don't people pay attention to this? But it's because my feeling is we've created this very artificial society, and we're very far away from a sense of connectedness with or a responsibility for the world around us. You know, I just think that's our culture. You know, our culture is makes human beings feel very separate from one another, you know, not cared for and not really caring for. But I think this is kind of like a symptom of larger cultural attitude, you know. Where, you know, feel very separate from not just other people, but from the world itself, you know. And so I think we've created this culture that's sort of like a toxic culture on many levels. And even though there's evidence that it's not working well, you know, people have a hard time seeing their own culture as artificial. You know, one of the nice things about, going to other countries is you realize that you don't have to live the way you live, you know. So a friend of mine who had never been to Europe, just came back and was just so impressed with the public transportation there. And this person is a typical American who drives a big car and so on. And realized, you know, if you have, you know, you don't have to sit in traffic on the turnpike for an hour and a half in each direction. You know, if we had the trains, you could take a nice train in and just have a little nap or have a coffee and be wonderful. But you know, Americans really don't know any better, right? And this is true also in so many other aspects of life, right? You know, it's hard to wake up from your culture. But, you know, if you keep sitting, if you keep practicing meditation, you really will begin to wake up from your culture. And you really will begin to experience life in a very different way. I mean, I always say this, and I'm sure you know what I mean, but, you know, I get up in the morning very early, like at 4:30 or 5 o'clock, and I honestly can't wait to sit. I mean, I honestly can't wait to sit. You know, and I get on the cushion, and all I can say is that there's this tremendous energy, but also there's this, you know, it's like having an intimate, the most intimate possible relationship to the world. I can't really, words can't do it justice, but it's like being with your best friend or being with someone you know, I don't know how to put it. It's like being a little bird in a nest, you know, and just sticking your head out and cheeping, you know. It's just so beautiful. It's the most intimate, beautiful thing in the world. It's just, you get up and you sit on the cushion and there's this world that you sort of diffuse outward into this world, and the self disappears and everything around you becomes part of this life, just your life, you know. It's absolutely the case, and it happens day after day after day. It's like the self disappears and suddenly the birds are me, everything is experienced like part of my own body. And I'm sure you've had experiences like this, and it's this huge living organism. You know, it's like this big living organism, and it's so beautiful, and so just I that's why I can't wait to get up. It's like that is so great, you know? And it's a different way to live. You know, humans don't have to be the unhappy creatures. We don't have to have 50% of Americans saying they're unhappy. But, you know, actually the solution isn't probably what people think. You know, I think that's 50% of the population. What is that? That's about 140 million unhappy people. Right? And they're all thinking, if I get this raise, if this happens to me, this comes through, you know, or, you know, then I'll be happy. And it might help, you know, naturally, you know, some things we want, we really need, you know. One of the people who was fixing my windows had really bad teeth. I felt so ashamed, you know, that I live in a country where everybody should have his teeth taken care of, you know. Just, there are places in the world where that's the case. Why don't we do that? Yeah. Well, we're just caught in this toxic culture, and also we're so disconnected, you know. But getting up in the morning, you know, and having the boundaries go down and feeling like this bigger life, really, I mean, I swear that this is how it is. I'm sure you've experienced it. If you multiply it by 30, this has happened to you, keep going, and then multiply by 30, and that's what it'll be like, you know. And it's just, it's heaven itself. It's like infinite life, you know. And this really, in a way, in my opinion, sort of solves the self-esteem problem. You know what I mean? Everything is my true self. Everything is my concern. And you know, you stop feeling so sorry for yourself, you know. And also, put things into perspective. You know, put things into perspective. You know, My wife showed me this article. My wife is a gardener, and she has a plant called a salvia. She plants it outside. And salvia, S-A-L-V-I-A, is becoming illegal because it's turned out that it's a hallucinogen. People have discovered that it's a hallucinogen. And so a number of states are pulling it off the off circulation, and it's all over our yard. Remember, I if you want to practice Zen, please don't use drugs. It's very important. It doesn't do what I'm just describing. You know, it won't get you there. It'll create obstacles. So please don't. Even salvia, don't do it. You know. But anyway, my wife showed me an article that she had somebody had sent her about salvia, and people have these salvia trips, you know. So they eat a little of these leaves, and then they have like a hallucination. And apparently, some people, when they take this drug, see this goddess-like figure. This is the lore of the drug. And actually, the reporter who wrote this story, took the salvia himself, and he saw the goddess. And he said to the goddess, "Tell me," he said, "you know, tell me the secrets of the universe. Tell me what's the secret of the universe?" And the goddess said, "You know, you give yourself too much credit. You know, or what did she say? She said, you're too self-important," or something like that. And I really don't think people should, what did she say? She said something like, I didn't quite get it right, but it's like she said, it's like, knock it off, you know, you're full, knock it off, the secrets of the universe, you know, you're full of beans or something like that. You know. And I really don't recommend using salvia, but I did like the goddess's answer. You're too self-important, you know. It's too, you know, come on, come off. And of course, these hallucinations run out, and the reporter did not say that his life was transformed by them. He said actually that anybody who uses this more than once a year is insane. But the goddess gave good advice. It's like, actually the path to this terrible pressure that's on us all to be worthy of respect and love and so on is unbearable sometimes, you know. And it makes us all very unhappy. And oddly, when we stop struggling to be a self, you know, when the boundaries between yourself and the world go away, the problem is solved, but not in the way that people think. You know, I was reading this interview with this this popular psychologist, and he was saying that Buddhism is about renunciation. He said, and that's not good. He said renunciation. And I of course didn't think he was correct. I mean, there's not really actually people wouldn't be so bad if people did renounce a few things. You know, like we have a consumer society where, you know, people just spend all day trying to invent new things that you should buy even though you don't need them. You know, so a little bit of renunciation wouldn't be so bad, right? But actually, Buddhism is not at all about non-attachment or renunciation, in my opinion. It's just getting free from illusions. And when you get free from your illusions, it's not non-attachment. This guy said it's cold aloofness, you know, or something like that, gray aloofness. And I can't imagine anything that's farther from from an awakened mind than that. You know, it's the very opposite. It's complete connectedness. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. A monk asked national teacher Zhang of Nanyang, what is the Virochana of one's own body? Virochana is one of these Mahayana Buddhas. Okay? It's like a in the later Buddhism, there were these Buddhas who were imagined as having lived at other times besides Siddhartha Gautama. This is a kind of a symbol, right? So, for example, Amitabha or Amida, Amitofo, is a Buddha of infinite light. It's not really a historical person. It's a symbol of something inside ourselves. A monk asked national teacher Zhang of Nanyang, what is the Virochana of one's own body? The Buddha of your own body, you know. And, you know, it's so hard. A person came to see me the other day and said, you know, I just can't believe what you've been saying. You know, you say that, we can be a Buddha. You know, we can have this experience. I just don't believe it. And my feeling is that this person really wanted me to argue with her, you know, and say, no, it's true. And indeed I did. I felt after a while I was getting nowhere. So I said, look, instead of trying to find Buddha, just ask where your own self-awareness is coming from. See, don't try to get to enlightenment. Just try to find out where your own awareness, even your own, where's your own anxiety coming from? You know, just look at your own mind and see where your thoughts are arising, from where are your thoughts arising, from where is your anxiety arising? See, that's very good meditation practice. You know, as you have a thought, try to see where the thought is. Very difficult. It's called vato. But try to see where the thought is arising. Look at your mind to see where the thoughts are coming from. But instead of trying to get to Buddha, just try to be in the moment until your fears and your small self disappear. You know, don't worry about becoming awake. Just try to be in the moment. You know, and the most wonderful thing happens. You know, if we just keep bringing the mind back to the moment, back to the moment, back to the moment, this prison that we often create for ourselves begins to disappear. And life suddenly is like a no-boundary life, you know. When I stop trying to protect myself, suddenly I can become very fearless, you know. If I let the small self go, I can suddenly, these walls go down and It's really like open in all directions. You know, another way to put it would be, it's like, you know, sometimes when you sit on the cushion, your mind just becomes as clear, unobstructed as like the coldest, purest water. I don't know if that's ever happened to you, but sometimes when you're sitting on the cushion, you may feel like your mind is just like water itself. You know, just pure water. It has no content. You know, water has no color, it has no odor, it has really actually no taste. This is like pure consciousness, you know. But you might even, you know, when you sit, you might even have images of water that pop into your head sometime. Don't hold on to those images. Those are very trivial. But the mind, the purified mind in accord with the way is really like water, you know? So we have a lot of self-esteem problems, maybe, and our culture does everything possible to increase your anxiety about this. It's absolutely the case. You know, you don't have the right kind of shoes. You're too tall. You're too short. You know, whatever. Your hair is too blonde, not blonde enough. Too gray, not gray enough, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, if you just bring your mind back to the moment, you let go of the self. You know, it's like a ocean of life. So, what is the Vairochana of one's? You know, there's a Buddha in your own body. You know, if you want to find Buddha, just sit on the cushion and to be with your own body. There's a Buddha in your own body. And when you enter that state, your mind becomes like a clear water. So refreshing. And then you can go out into your life. You can get off the cushion and go into your life, and you have like real joy. You know, it's like real joy, real greater sense of freedom, less fear. And of course, you know, we live in a toxic culture, you know, so, you know, please keep sitting. And but the more you enter this state, the more you enter this beautiful state of no boundaries, you know, the healthier you become. And if you spend your life there, you know, you can be tremendously helpful to other people who are in so much unhappiness. Yes, 140 million unhappy people. So they're not all going to sit, but you might run into some of them and you can help them a little bit. So thank you for coming to practice today and walking this beautiful, beautiful path. And please keep walking on it. And it won't, if you keep walking on it, it will not fail you. You know, it's the most, in my opinion, the most beautiful thing in the world.